Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring the intersection of research and practice. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and my guest today is Mark Fuge, assistant professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Maryland. So, you know, throughout the conversation, you've mentioned the concept and reality of machine learning. So, you know, it's often touted as a kind of, and I don't want to overstate myself, but here, as a kind of universal silver bullet for many problems. So can you give us a specific definition of what we are talking about when we say machine learning? And from your perspective, why is it not necessarily that silver bullet?
Okay. So when people think about machine learning, the sort of 30,000-foot view of that is basically some math that I can learn from data so that I can make new predictions of things, right? So at the end of the day, it comes down to I see examples, and then I learn some function that I can compute that then can predict a new thing. So I feed it an image. It tells me, is it a cat or not, right? And this is a remarkable idea. It's remarkably general in that you can apply it to lots of different problems. And recently, there's been lots of success, right? So in the news, you've probably heard a lot about the term, you know, deep learning or the AlphaGo, you know, where the computer beat a human playing Go, which people didn't even think was going to be possible for another decade. And again, it's this idea of I can take examples and I can kind of learn from that patterns, that then those patterns will help me predict future performance. And so there's a lot of power there. What's tricky with that is that people, it can be difficult to know if based on our, you know, what we were talking about earlier, kind of when to trust those models. Like, how do I know under what conditions it is or is not true? And does it apply for all problems? So generally speaking, the harder the problem, the more data I need to find something that fits it well. And for certain things, we just don't have lots of data for that.
So, you know, coming towards the crescendo, if you will, of this very interesting conversation around data-driven design and its application right now, I'd like to talk about. And what I mean by that is I'd like to explore some of the successes. So could you elaborate, identify, discuss examples of application successes of data-driven design in any industry? And then the next question I would have is around government.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I think you're going to see many cases in which you can use these, machine learning in general, and then specifically the application of machine learning to the design of new products is a fairly new field. So when we take a look at things like data-driven models for industrial products, you'll hear a lot of terms being used today by creating digital twins. So the idea behind this is if I'm GE and I have a jet engine and it's flying on my plane, I'd like to know something about how that engine's going to do. Like, when do I need to take it down? Because I don't want to have people sitting on the runway waiting for me to fix it. I'd like to get that fixed before everyone's unhappy because they want to go home to their families. I would like to construct a digital version of that. So I can look at what the engine's doing, and then I create kind of a digital mock-up of this internally that I can kind of keep track on it, right? That's the twin aspect, if I had a twin for this. So people have used machine learning a lot for analyzing existing designs that are there. So when is the machine going to break down? Can I service it before it does so people aren't upset with me? Can I replace a part before it breaks so it can be safer? So these are examples that people use right now in industrial equipment. So the jet engine example is in use right now. People do this for cars. They'll do this for cell phones as well. You can basically detect when parts are going to break on things like smartphones by looking at where it's been, what the accelerometer tells me, has someone dropped it recently. Those are current industry examples. Being able to then take that and redesign products based on that is something that's very like late breaking stuff. I mean, this has really only been maybe 5 years, 6 years that people in the design community have been using, at least in mechanical engineering, have been using this to do that. So it takes a little while for that technology to work its way into products just because it takes a while for products to come onto the market.
So, you know, whether it's this, maybe it's even the conceptualization of design, data-driven design, do you see any of this being adopted or adapted to government and the delivery of government services or in the public sector in general?
Sure, definitely. So, for example, in a lot of the work that we do, we'll partner with government agencies that are generally producing products, because I'm a mechanical engineer, although this general idea of how can we use design to help people be better can apply to lots of different agencies. But where you'll see this a lot is in defense and energy, so things where there's physical products going on. So for an example, actually, we're currently working on a project looking at designing new kinds of materials. So can I make a car lighter? Can I make fuel lighter and more effective? And that's a case where obviously the energy, Department of Energy is very interested in that. The Department of Defense is obviously very interested in that. So those are both cases where the agencies that we're working for need to provide services to people, and those services depend on products performing at a certain level. And so the idea is, can we use data to help us make aircraft that are twice as powerful or lighter? Can we make fuel that we can transport safely that's not going to be in any danger to people? These are all questions that data-driven models and data-driven design can help people answer.
Would you say it's fairly in its infancy then?
Yes and no. So like, for example, we're working on a project right now where we're looking at aircraft design, so improving aircraft designs for the Department of Defense. And in those cases, we've actually had some early successes where we've been able to show that you can get maybe 1 to 2 orders of magnitude reduction in terms of the amount of cost and time it takes for you to make aircraft better. So like the human time necessary to compute it. But that's still a long way from being fielded in any specific thing, because those things take 30 to 40 years from start to finish. So hopefully the seeds that we're laying today will grow fruit in 30 years. And I think that's sometimes the difficulty with connecting research to practice. And it's in these little ways of my airplane ticket being a little less expensive than it would have been, or me being able to get twice as much mileage out of my car. Little things that people don't think about when you're actually using the product really got their start many, many years earlier.
Are there interesting ways you can teach engineering today, and engineers, soon to be engineers, to think about how best to bridge the worlds of the digital and the physical world?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, because we're living in an age now where, traditionally, right, what is engineering, right? So engineering is using the tools from science and math to solve real people's problems. And traditionally, mechanical engineers have been doing things that make things move or that produce power. So think cars, batteries, things like that. And for hundreds of years, the solution, the sort of science and math that we use is Newtonian physics, so the stuff you learned about in high school physics class, and basically calculus. And those are really good tools. We've been using that for many hundreds of years, and they'll continue to serve us well into the future. But now what you're finding is that there's a whole host of other things that engineers can use, a whole other set of tools we can use to solve people's problems that students are now interested in and that have real applications. So this machine learning and statistics stuff is not the kind of thing that typically you would get in, your high school physics and math, and even through your college education. But those are really valuable tools to supplement what we know about the physical world. So the kind of students that end up taking, the course, so I teach a course in applied machine learning for engineering and design. And one of the questions, and students show up and they say, oh, well, I'm really interested in how these, how can my Nest thermostat learn, what I'm doing, and how does it adjust my system? Like, can I make the building? Can I make an entire building much more efficient if I'm able to learn who's in the office when, and where do I need to put where do I need to pump cool air and not? So there's all these questions that these students are going to be faced with when they go and work for companies, and being able to interact with computer scientists, to interact with electrical engineers, to interact with policy experts, to talk about, what implications do these data sources now have on the traditional physics and math that I would do in my engineering education is, I think, really important.
That's great. So, as we come to the close of the conversation, I was wondering, what does the future hold in this area? And perhaps you could give us a sense of where is it going?
Sure. I mean, so if I was to kind of wave my big magic wand and look at the 50 years from now, how is the world going to be different? I think what you're going to see is that right now, when we think about how we interact with products, it's almost like I go to the store, I buy it, that's the product that I bought. It works the way that I bought it to, and maybe it breaks over time, and then I buy a new product. I think what you're going to see in the future is the products that actually adapt to how we work and how we live. And that, to me, is exciting because we think of software as being able to update, you know, optimize. So, you know, Facebook learns something about me and then they can update how my experience and it improves my life in some cases. I think people don't think of products that way, but I think in the future we will. So we'll think about products that adapt to how we use them, that improve over time once they learn more about us, and just products that end up being less expensive, that perform better because they're able to take in data and understand how everybody else who's using their product is working with it. So if it understands that I'm having this issue and it sees that everybody else is also having that same issue, okay, it's time to roll out a fix to that product. So I think that's going to be a big sea change in terms of thinking of our products not as things, but as kind of almost living artifacts that can change with us, and then the new things are kind of better customized to us, where we can kind of live in symbiosis between the things that we produce and how we live our lives.
And a lot of these things, your vision as you lay it out, it has implications for, you know, regulatory implications, governmental implications. And that's why I was glad to have you on today, because you're looking into the future. You're doing the future now in some respects. As you said, you plant the seed, and R&D and research, the intersection between research and practice is maybe something that was planted 30 years ago, and it's bearing the fruit now. But, you know, I think it's a wonderful conversation. I'm glad we were able to do it. Thank you for coming in. I was wondering, if people want to get to know more about your work, how can they reach you?
Sure. So you can Google my name. I'm the first hit on Google. You can also go to my website, which is ideal.umd.edu. There we have access to the papers that we've written, some of the classes that we teach, and also open source code that can do some of the stuff that I've been talking about.
Well, Mark, thanks again.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
This has been a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring the intersection of research and practice with Mark Fuge, assistant professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Maryland. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan. Thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.